When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Allo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, September 16th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about LEGO Star Wars Rebuild the Galaxy, and we will present interviews with that project's writers and star. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, Brad, I'm going to be straight with you. I've never watched any of the LEGO Star Wars projects, but we had some cool interview opportunities come up for this one. So I was wondering what your relationship was to these LEGO Star Wars things specifically. I think both of us have seen the LEGO movies, or some of them anyway. I never got around to seeing LEGO Ninjago. But have you ever dipped into this world before of these LEGO Star Wars projects?
Yes, a ton of them, but some of the more prominent ones. I actually did a review of the LEGO holiday special they did, and one of the things that's fun about the LEGO Star Wars movies is they literally can just be a little bit more goofy. They're not necessarily need to like adhere to the deepest, you know, most serious side of Star Wars mythology. They definitely still reference it and use it to fuel the stories, but it's made to be a little more meta, a little more silly. There's lots of comedy that's like family friendly in there. And like my initial experience with LEGO Star Wars, aside from having LEGO Star Wars sets, was through the video games, which also have that kind of playful approach. But what people might not know if they've never dug into the LEGO Star Wars animated stuff is some of them are really truly funny, because the creators get a lot of freedom to kind of just play around with what is literally Star Wars toys. And because they don't have to be as sacred about the Star Wars mythology, they can have a lot more fun with it. And this one actually, I think, is the one that gets to have the most fun, because in case you haven't heard, LEGO Star Wars Rebuild the Galaxy is a story where the entire Star Wars universe gets completely turned on its head, where certain heroes are now villains, certain villains are now heroes. There's like a dark version of the Millennium Falcon. Relationships have been completely changed. It's an entirely different universe, basically almost as if it were like a Marvel what if version of Star Wars, but in the LEGO universe.
So I'm curious about that humor that you mentioned, because I was looking at the cast list here, and you have an interview with Gaten Matarazzo from Stranger Things, who stars in this thing. But there's also like Bobby Moynihan is in this. Tony Revolori is in this. Marseille Martin is in this. And then you've got some Star Wars veterans in the form of Ahmaud Best, who played Jar Jar Binks. And then Mark Hamill himself is also in this as well. So would you say that this is I think you said this is one that allows the creators to sort of have some fun and bend the rules in terms of Star Wars lore and stuff like that. But how would you categorize this in terms of the comedy of it all?
It's pretty funny. You know, it's you're not going to find yourself, you know, having ruckus fits of laughter, right? We're not talking about like, you know, 21 Jump Street or anything here. But there's amusing like meta jokes about Star Wars characters and creatures and those kinds of things. There's even kind of like, there's meta commentary that like kind of alludes to like the movies like themselves as media in a way, especially because Gaten's character in this movie, he's kind of like a Star Wars fanboy. He's very well aware of like the Star Wars legends that happen in this universe. You know, he knows about Luke Skywalker and Rey and all these things. And so he's kind of like this person who tells, you know, the kids on his planet, like the stories of Star Wars. And he's very, very familiar with it, like any Star Wars fan would be talking to their kids about it. And so his name is Sig Griebling. And that makes for a lot of fun when you get to see like how they get caught up in the Star Wars universe and what happens. Tony Revolori plays his brother, and his character takes an interesting turn. Bobby Moynihan's character is a guy named Jedi Bob, which is something that's pulled from like deep Lego Star Wars lore to the point where today all the Lego Star Wars minifigures are like painted and colored to be like the same color that their characters are in the universe, like skin tones and whatnot. Hmm. But a long time back, Star Wars minifigures used to have to adhere to the same rules that regular Lego minifigures were, and they didn't have different skin tones. They were all yellow. And so Jedi Bob is an old school Lego figure who is still has yellow head and hands and stuff. And you can even see like that he's supposed to be an older minifigure because the beard paint on his head is like scratched off and faded a little bit.
That's actually a good transition into my next question for you, which was the visuals of this thing. I've seen the trailer, but it's actually been a little while since I watched it. But how would you compare this to something like the Lego Movie, which obviously had like a decent enough budget to look great on the big screen? And this is made for Disney Plus, right? So I expect it doesn't look quite as great as that. But how would you say the visual struck you?
Yeah, it's not quite as immersive because and this is something that has kind of varied with Lego productions, even in the big screen movies, is because one of my favorite things about the Lego Movie, the original one that Phil Lord and Chris Miller did, is that everything in the Lego Movie was made of Lego bricks. And that's probably pretty difficult to render in animation. And since these are have to be a little bit lower budget, they don't quite have everything made out of Lego bricks. Like the land, like as far as like grass and stuff like that, you'll still see like little pieces of Lego shrubbery every now and then. But like the entire grass isn't necessarily Lego bricks. You know, it's like there's some like grass texture and stuff like that. And there's actual mm-hmm. sky and, you know, there's not always Lego water like there is in the Lego Movie. You know, sometimes it's actual water, but all the ships and characters and stuff are still made of Legos. It still looks pretty good though. You know, especially when it comes to the action and how they utilize the basically the basic function of Lego bricks and how the characters can actually build and deconstruct and put together pieces in new ways. That's a lot of fun, similar to how the Lego Movie was. So there's some pretty cool things that they actually do, especially in this particular special, because they remix so many of the vehicles and whatnot.
Excellent. Okay, so what else did you think is maybe worth talking about here? For I'm guessing a lot of our listeners probably have not watched this, but this could be an opportunity to get people to tune in and check it out. So what would you say to people who maybe are on the fence about that?
You know, it's just kind of an opportunity to see things that like would never ever be possible in real Star Wars with, you know, an amusing angle. You know, if you see in the original trailer for Rebuild the Galaxy that they introduce Darth Jar Jar, it is a dark side version of Jar Jar. He still talks like Jar Jar, just a little bit more menacing, but he says stuff like, yeah, Misa thinking Yuuza people are gonna die.
And Darth Jar Jar is like, I don't know if it's not canonical as far as I know, but there's been a lot of like internet theories and stuff like that about that character. So they're actually like bringing that to life in some way, right? Is this the first time that we've seen something like that?
Yeah, 100%. This is the first time at least we've seen it in like an official Star Wars, you know, capacity. And they do make some very clear references to the fact that like there was the theory going around that Jar Jar Binks is the real Phantom Menace and stuff like that. My favorite thing that they do actually is the spin that they put on Luke Skywalker. They got Mark Hamill to come back. And in this universe, Luke Skywalker isn't the Luke Skywalker that you know. He's not a villain either. He's kind of like a Point Break version of Luke Skywalker. He's kind of just bumming around Tatooine and using the Force to cheat on pod races.
Point Break? Wait, what's the Point Break connection?
When you see what he looks like, you'll be like, oh yeah, that's Patrick Swayze from Point Break.
Oh man, Luke Skywalker is Bodhi. That might be enough to get me to check this out.
He's got shaggier hair. He's got a little bit of like a, he's got a scruffy beard. He's wearing a vest with no shirt under it. And he even has the Jaipur snippet necklace that Anakin gave Padme in The Phantom Menace.
I was just going to say you're speaking my language with this Point Break stuff, but then you dropped this deep cut Phantom Menace thing that I have no idea what you're talking about. But
It's okay. You don't need to appreciate that he looks like he's wearing, like, it's basically supposed to be like if he was wearing like a puka shell necklace or like a shark tooth necklace.
Excellent.
And it's a portrayal of Luke that Mark Hamill's having a lot of fun with the role. So that's a really enjoyable thing to see. And you get to see a lot of other like dark side versions of characters you haven't seen. Cause like it flips like entire, you know, rules on their head. Like in the regular Star Wars universe, there have only ever been like two Sith at a given time. In Rebuild the Galaxy, there are just as many Sith, if not more, than there are Jedi. In the Star Wars. And so you get to see a lot of characters carrying around red lightsabers and whatnot. So there's cool stuff here. It really is just kind of just a fun, lighthearted romp through Star Wars that, you know, only Lego could do.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a break and then we'll come back and get into your interviews.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle, available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
All right, so first up, you spoke with Dan Hernandez and Benji Samet, who are the writers of this project. People might recognize them from their credits writing Pokemon Detective Pikachu, the movie. They also were co-writers of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, which you and I both loved. They've worked on some TV stuff as well. They worked on, I think, 1600 Pen and Central Park and The Tick. But
And now they're supposed to be doing the Spaceball sequel with Josh Gad as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So there's a little bit of a Star Wars connection there. I'm hoping that you spoke with them and about that. And we'll find out right now, because here is the audio from that conversation.
So just to start off with, I kind of wanted to go back to the beginning and ask how you two started working together. When did you guys realize that you would make such great collaborators?
We started working together in college. We went to college together. We went to Brown and... yeah, we did a lot of theater in college. That's where we first met. And the first time we actually worked together was our senior year of college. The theater program at Brown was sort of the de facto theater thesis, is you write and star in your own hour-long solo show. Okay. And it's this long, you know, 6 month process of working on the show, and what they sort of do to stop you from, you know, from madness is they pair you up with someone else who's going through it. You're directing each other's shows. You're helping each other out, and we were chosen to pair up, and so it was this 6 month process of working together all day, every day on these shows. And it was just like a great creative collaboration. And, you know, we sort of knew from there that we didn't want to stop. Yeah.
Was there ever like a key moment for either one of you where like, oh man, like, yeah, like this guy gets me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we were doing a piece of theater. The first time we ever met is I was acting in a play. Benji was doing the technical direction for the play, and they flooded this black box theater with water, actually. And it just the water got really gross over time, and it was growing algae, and it was like really nasty. And so the day that it was time to strike the set, they were like, all right, everybody, time to drain the water out of this like fetid pool. And I had never said one word to Benji, but our eyes met from like across the, you know, the great divide. And we just like completely understood each other's souls in that moment. And so like, as people were trying to get rid of this water, I actually decided to go hide. It wasn't like my bravest moment, but I said, I can't be a part of this. And so I ducked into the lighting booth, and who should I find up there also, you know, cleaning up, but really also hiding.
Yeah, I was doing important work up there.
Technical work up there was Benji. And so that was actually the first time that we ever spoke. And it was based on this sort of shared mind meld of like, what did we get ourselves into here?
That's great. I wanted to ask what is your writing process like when you're a pair? I'm sure you're not necessarily like both sitting at the same computer. Do you each write individual scenes and trade off notes and then rewrite? Or do you guys have any rituals before you start writing, like watching certain movies to get you into a groove?
I mean, I would say our process varies sometimes. Like sometimes it really is just the two of us sitting at the same computer together, going through it and writing words. Sometimes that's part of the process. The stuff that definitely always happens is before we start writing anything, we talk about it a lot in detail. And we really like having like a roadmap and an outline and knowing where we're going with the story, knowing, about our characters, what the themes are, what the emotional journey we want to take is, and really talking it through the two of us. And from there, a lot of the time, like once we have it, once we're on the same page about exactly what it's going to be, one of us will start writing a draft, and then yeah, it's a lot of sending things back and forth, and just each time like refining it, changing things, tweaking it. And so it's like by the time the two of us are done with a draft, it's already like sort of gone through multiple internal drafts, like of just us rewriting each other. Yeah, what am I forgetting, Dan?
I think that's right. I mean, it definitely gets to the point where you forget who wrote which line, and sometimes I'll congratulate Benji on a line that I think is funny, and he'll go, "You wrote that line." And it's not that I'm fishing for compliments for myself, although that would be a good way to do it. But I really forget a lot of the time, and also sometimes because of the sort of the speed in which you're doing things and the amount of, versions that you're doing, like you do kind of forget sometimes what you banged out or something that you threw in, and then you see it later and you go, "Oh, that was good." And so we both do that. We both kind of forget. And I think that there's a process of total trust in each other's artistic writing instincts that we've developed over time, because never am I uptight if he cut something that I wrote, because I just at this point know if he cut it, there's a reason that he cut it, and there's something, that this is he's for my own good here. And I think if I change something that he's done, I think it's the same thing. It's like, and I think that because we care about slightly different things, I think that actually ends up being great because our skill sets are complementary in that way. And so if there's something that Benji feels really passionately about, I will defer to him because I know that he really knows what he's talking about, and I think vice versa. So it's been a really great collaboration. Of course, it's been over the course of, almost 20 years at this point, or over 20 years at this. What? How long has it been? Wait, just about
Probably
20,
just
almost,
about
yeah,
20
just about
years,
20. We're almost at the 20-year anniversary. We got to look up
there
what we
you
got to get each other.
go.
Now, obviously, you're big Star Wars fans. I don't want to get you guys in any hot water, but since this is the first story set after Rise of Skywalker, I wanted to kind of get your take on how the new trilogy ended and how you feel like about how Rise of Skywalker followed up The Last Jedi, because that's like a big, point of contention among Star Wars fans.
Yeah, I mean, look, like there's so much that we love about the new trilogy. Like, I mean, Rey is an all-time great character, and the ending of Rise of Skywalker left me excited for seeing more of what's going on with Rey and building a new Jedi Order and all the potential that's still to come. So, I'm on board with like, yeah, let's I'm excited for, seeing Rey and the new Jedi.
Our attitude has always been to holistically accept everything that's come before in Star Wars and to try and find the things that really get us excited. One of the things that I was really excited about in this special is bringing the character of Janna into it, someone that I thought was really great in Rise of Skywalker that I wanted to spend more time with. And I think part of the responsibility of being the first thing said after Rise of Skywalker is to really say, embrace all that's come before. We have hopefully an understanding of the total swath of Star Wars history. And now in order to like rebuild it, you kind of have to accept it to begin with, and then figure out the points of differentiation and where things get mixed up and where things get meshed up. But overall, we're just huge fans of everything.
Yeah. To shift into Star Wars Rebuild the Galaxy, I think it's kind of funny too, because even though this takes place after Rise of Skywalker, it completely undoes the entire Star Wars universe and goes into a completely different direction.
Yes, there's that, yeah.
So were you given a pretty open playing field to do whatever you wanted? Were there certain pieces of the universe you couldn't mess with that you got pushback from Lucasfilm about?
You know, we thought there would be. We thought that, you know, like when we first started working on it, you know, we were like, oh, this is Lucasfilm. Like, what are we going to be able to get away with? Like, this is, you know, we were a little intimidated, and we, you know, started just like writing things. Like, they never told us ahead of time things we couldn't do. So we were just like, oh, surely they're going to say no to this, or they're going to question that, or like, are they going to really let us do Darth Jar Jar or things like that? But every step of the way, you know, they just kept saying, yeah, that's great. Because everyone really was on board with what we wanted to do with this project and the sort of philosophy behind it, and really embracing that way that kids and adults too play with Lego. That, you know, it all felt spiritually true to Lego Star Wars. So, you know, it was, yeah, we just got to do what we wanted to do. It was really, really freeing and fun.
We've been really fortunate in our careers thus far to be entrusted with really big properties that mean a lot to a lot of people. And we take that very seriously, because I think our background is fans, is that of fans. And we, before we were professional writers, we would talk about all of these things passionately the same way that people do. And so when we get the opportunity to change things, you always have to put it through the filter of, is this too much? Is this being done for the right reasons? And in general, in this one, we kind of honed in on this idea of, if it was serving the story, the bigger story, you know, we weren't going to do something just to do it. We really decided that there had to be a reason. And even if that reason for things being a little bit different in this galaxy is not articulated on screen, Benji and I had reasons in our mind that this galaxy kind of unfolded the way that it did. And I think that gave it a lived in quality that made it feel more than random, but rather that there was like a little bit of organization to this rebuilt galaxy, because we did actually spend a lot of time thinking about, okay, like, what are the underpinnings of this galaxy? How did this history unfold? I busted out the star charts to make sure that the planets were near each other and that was sensible on the hyperspace lanes. Like, we got like deep on this. And so I think that Lucasfilm and Lego saw that we really did the homework, and that gave them confidence, I think, in letting us kind of try out some pretty weird stuff. And they never said no. They just said, keep going, make it weirder.
Were there any ideas that you had that you really liked but unfortunately didn't fit into the story, that you had to just end up taking out for whatever reason?
Yeah, there were definitely quite a few. You know, like, it's, well, when you only have, you know, 4 22-minute episodes, it's hard to squeeze everything in there, you know, and you know, there are a lot of characters that we would have loved to fit in. Like, you know, there are some, you know, notable omissions, because there's only so many characters you can squeeze into that short of amount of time. And, you know, like, our initial drafts, it was like, you know, every character, every planet, every ship, every creature, every possible thing that
it was a little like a toy. It was a little like a Toys R Us shopping spree. If anyone remembers Toys R Us, maybe I just revealed my age, but it was like a guy's grocery game shopping spree. I don't know. It's modern. But
yes, I want that. I want that. I want that. I want that.
Yeah, that. Oh, yeah. Oh, we got to have a Gungan.
And then it was just like, you know, some of the first like rough animatic cuts of the show. Like, it was like, this episode is 15 minutes too long. And so, you know, we had to to cut a lot of fun, ideas. One that made it pretty far towards the end was we had Poe Dameron. He was not the world's not the galaxy's greatest pilot, but he was the galaxy's greatest valet parker. And there we had a big scene where they really needed to park, and he was the man for the job. And that was fun. And there were a bunch of things like
We
that.
had a sea sarlacc at one point on Tatooine that I was excited about, but that Servo got sucked up by a sea sarlacc and then kind of got spit out because he is, seemingly indestructible gonk droid. And there were some really there were some cool things like that, but ultimately, as you're having to make tough decisions, you just some things have to fall away, and then they.
And a lot of what we winnowed things down to was like what benefited the story the most. Like, sometimes if something was just like silly for the sake of silly, there's a few things like that still managed to make their way through. But a lot of the surprises and characters and gags and things really were there. The ones that remained were the ones that really connected to Sig's journey in a real way and helped illustrate some of what's going on in the galaxy.
That's cool. Shifting direction a little bit, 1600 Pen was your first TV show a long time ago. I really dug that show, and I was so bummed that it only got a single season because it was really funny.
Thank you.
I
We
completely agree. I didn't expect the 1600 Pen talk, but I'm
there's
glad for it
the
because we
pen
love
there
that show.
there are pen heads out there.
The pen heads are still out there. We are a silent, very tiny minority.
Every once in a blue moon we meet one, and it's
What was that experience like, being on a big network comedy as your first, writing gig like that?
I have to say that I think it was the best possible training ground for what we ultimately went on to do in our careers because it was, it's a family sitcom set in the White House, but the people that we were working with, all of whom have gone on to incredible success. I mean, Mike Royce, who's like a legendary showrunner, Jason Weiner is one of the biggest TV directors, and John Lovett, who, sort of shifted gears and became like a media mogul and, is one of our closest friends. But we met all these people on 1600 Pen. Almost every single person in the writer's room of 1600 Pen has gone on to be a showrunner, including Joe Wiseman and Joe Port, who created the American version of Ghosts, Sanjay Shah, who's doing the new Everybody Hates Chris and did Central Park. Just down the line, as young writers, we really got to train in a very kind of classic TV style because it was a network show, and we really got to understand the rhythms of what was required of you as a collaborator, as a creative, sort of the low person on the total on the on the on the the low person on the hierarchy. And that was really useful because we had a lot of because when you work in network television, you have time constraints. You have practical budgetary constraints. I remember early on in the writer's room, I pitched a joke, and I think it was Weiner, Jason Weiner said, "That's a great joke. Unfortunately, it'll cost $100,000 to get like a lion or something." I don't remember, but it was like some animal joke. And that was the first time that I sort of thought to myself, "Oh, right, we actually have to go make these things. It's not just a matter of like what's the funniest, craziest thing you can think of, which can be really great, but then it's like somebody's job to be like, okay, like where are we hiring the lion from? How many days can the lion work? What's the cost of the lion? What's the no, okay, we're getting a lion. Now we got to hire an animal safety person. So then you start to realize, oh, okay, right. I need to think about our writing in a different way. And I think that when you're writing for animation, all of that sort of training and thinking about creative solutions to things, and you have more time on an animated thing just because of the nature of it, but you still run into a lot of the same constraint problems, which is to say, like, you came up with something really great. Unfortunately, the reality of trying to get that on screen at the price point that we have is not going to work. But what if we did this? And then you go, okay, you know what? Well, that actually is cool, but let's add this to it. And now suddenly you've collaborated with, you know, the director and the animators and everyone to find a solution that works and is equally as good creatively. And I think that a lot of our training on 600 Pen and just experiencing that network system really prepared us going forward for how to be collaborative, especially on big movie properties, because, you know, like Ninja Turtles or Pokemon or things that we've done where there are a lot of cooks in those kitchens just by the nature of all the people that have to be consulted and, you know, weigh in. And the other thing that working in a network writers room allowed us to do is to kind of synthesize a bunch of different notes, oftentimes from people who were kind of saying, this is how it has to be.
Yeah.
And then figuring out, okay, how can I do the best possible version of this script within the parameters that like all these different things are getting thrown at me?
Yeah. So I think it's appropriate that you guys just remix the Star Wars universe with Lego, and then you also have Spaceballs 2 on the horizon, and you get to work with Josh Gad again after you started all the way back with 1600 Pen. Is there anything you can tell me about Spaceballs 2 to kind of just tease what's in store?
What can we tell? We can't tell you a whole lot, but what we can tell you is, you know, I think it's clear from Rebuild the Galaxy how much we love Star Wars and what big fans of that type of story we are, and we are, you know, just as big of fans of Mel Brooks and Spaceballs, and so yeah, it's been super fun to dip our toes in both versions of the galaxy, you know? And yeah, we're really excited for people to see it and to make that one because yeah, it's a fun one.
And Mel is as amazing as you hoped that he would be.
Yeah.
That's the main thing that I've taken from it, is that he's funny, he's sharp, he's improvising, he's giving thoughts, he's giving really great comedy notes and advice, and it doesn't seem real every time that we get to hang out with him. And so, you know, he is so firmly a part of this that it makes us feel proud to even get to be in the same atmosphere of him as him.
At one point, Josh was supposed to do a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids Lego sequel with Rick Moranis. Has that made it any more likely that Dark Helmet might return for Spaceballs 2?
They, you know, that would be cool, wouldn't it?
It's a big, yeah.
Josh and Rick do have a relationship, and yeah. Let's see what we can
Let's
do.
see what happens.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
And then I just to wrap up here, are you guys working on the Mutant Mayhem sequel at all for Ninja Turtles?
For sure. Yeah. We've worked on
Yep.
that. They're hard at now. They're in the animation phase right now, and it's I'm very excited for people to see what we're cooking up with that one, because you know we left it on a pretty big cliffhanger at the end of the first
A
one,
very a
and
pointed cliffhanger, you might say.
yes, a very
Very,
sharp and
a very
pointed
pointed
cliffhanger,
cliffhanger. Multiple points of
many points, and
cliffhanger.
I think people will be
Not disappointed.
not disappointed to see what happens.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I can't wait to see what you guys have in store for that, and really just everything you guys work on. You guys are just a great, you know, writing duo, and yeah, I'm super psyched.
Thank you
Thank
so much. It was really, really good. And you gave us some questions we hadn't talked about before. So always really appreciate it.
That's awesome. I'm glad. Yeah, I'm sure it's an exhausting process going through this over and over again.
It's cool and it's fun, but it's also fun when we get to talk about something totally different. Like, no one has asked us about our network experience, and I actually think it's pretty important to our kind of shared history. So I'm really glad we got to talk about it.
Awesome. Well, that's my time. Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate
All
it.
right, man.
And then you also had a chance to talk to, as we mentioned, Gaten Matarazzo. And anything you want to say for this one in terms of setting it up or anything?
No, it was great talking to Gaten. He's 22 years old now, which is crazy to think. You know, he still seems like he's a kid because of Stranger Things, but you know, he's in his 20s and growing up, but he's still just a big kid at heart. He's still very much a Star Wars geek. He's a musical theater kid. I don't know if you know this, but like he's done stuff on stage. Like he was in Les Mis when he was younger. He recently did a run on Sweeney Todd. And so he has a love for musicals. He's a Star Wars like geek in the way that he has his own custom lightsabers, like even outside of Disneyland. He's like, we talk about that. We dig a little bit into Stranger Things. I asked him about his cameo in the Please Don't Destroy movie. And so it's just a cool, you know, wandering conversation about, you know, his career and like how he came to fall in love with Star Wars, his experience with the movies and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I hope you guys like hearing from him.
Excellent. Here is Brad's conversation with Gaten Matarazzo.
Now, I wanted to start off by going back to your earliest experience with Star Wars. Since you're a younger fan, where did your fandom begin? Was it the original trilogy? Was it the prequels?
It's the original. Well, weirdly enough, it was growing to start to be the prequel trilogy. And my mom and my uncle shut that down because they needed me to know, like, they needed me to know where it all started first. Because when I started becoming a fan is when Clone Wars was still airing. And so I was like, because I was watching Cartoon Network and stuff, and I saw that Star Wars was there. I thought it looked cool. And my mom was like, no, we're going to watch them. And we started with the original trilogy, and then it just became my first obsession. Like, it was the first thing that I was like, just genuinely absolutely floored by. And the rest is history kind of from there. That we did the originals. I cried at how excited I was about that, and then I saw the prequels, and of course at like 6 years old, when you see the jump from like the originals to the prequels when it comes to like the lightsaber fighting and stuff, I was just so ecstatic to be a fan of Star Wars, and I remain so. And I have prop lightsabers and posters and a drunken tattoo and like the whole nine yards, and it's just like,
what's the drunken tattoo?
I got the Tatooine sunset over at Luke's hut, which I think is pretty cool. As far as drunk tattoos go, it's not the worst in the world, so I'm thankful.
No, it could have been way worse.
Yeah, I know. There are way worse ones out there, for sure. But this is a dream come true.
That's awesome. So have you been able to see the original trilogy in theaters then since because I imagine
I've seen screenings. Yeah, I've anytime like there's one nearby and they're showing any movie, I'll go. And so I've seen, I think, pretty much every Star Wars movie in theaters now, which is good. I really, of course, I was able to somewhat emulate that like excitement and experience when the sequels came out because I was already such a big fan when they started releasing. So I remember seeing Force Awakens in theater and kind of having that same experience that my mom and my uncle got to when they were so excited about the first one coming out and the prequels as well. So it was cool that was an experience that I got to have alongside my my family.
That's great. Now, this is the first Star Wars story set after Rise of Skywalker, so I was curious, how did you feel about the end of the sequel trilogy? And in a related question, how do you feel about The Last Jedi?
I think, like, I understand the route that it took, for sure. And I think, like, it was cool to see that set plan kind of, like, finish out and see. It's just, like, anytime you see, like, a story that's, like, been building over the course of 50 years, just to see it wrap up in that fashion and in the it looks so stunning and it's so exciting and it's it was really rad. I'm so stoked I got to see that in theaters. Like I said, I got to like emulate that own experience and stuff. And what's fun about this though, about Rebuild the Galaxy, is that it's so low stakes. Like, it takes place after Rise of Skywalker when we know the entire arc of the story, and because of that, it gets the opportunity for a character like Sig, who can actually be like a Star Wars fan, who can think of the stories of past and like be obsessed with them, about like the whole arc starting from Anakin, Luke, Rey, and seeing all of that like play out in a really fun, goofy, low stakes manner that is written like to perfection by Dan and Benji, is just rad. It's so cool.
I think it's kind of funny too that like, because the character is such a Star Wars fan, the story is set on its path by completely destroying the main Star Wars universe.
Yeah, right. It rocks. I think it's so fun, and also I think that's kind of what makes it's like it's going to be a cool opportunity for fans of the show to like enjoy, because you know, like, Star Wars fans are hard to please and always have been, and I think like anything that comes out in the world of Star Wars is always going to be polarizing because it's the biggest fan base in the world, in the biggest franchise in the world. And so it's like impossible to have everybody universally like love everything that comes out. So it's cool to have something that where it's like, all right, let's chill out and just remember why we love Star Wars, which is because it's fun and the world is vibrant and exciting. And we all remember why it is we fell in love with these movies in the first place. And it's a good reminder of that. Like, it's just like, this is just, we're here to have fun and enjoy it. And I think Rebuild the Galaxy does it really, really well. And it's just fun to see everything get turned on its head, like you said.
Yeah. What were the, some of the alternate takes in Rebuild the Galaxy that, like, you were so excited to see?
I keep saying it in other interviews, but my favorite one, I think, is when Greedo and Leia end up together in this new universe. That's so funny. Because it literally is just a play on the joke, who shot first.
Yeah.
Greedo shot who shot first. And that's so, it's such a funny little spin on just like a weird little pun that they make a full plot point out of. It's yeah. such a damn Benji move to just be like, isn't that hilarious that he shot a shot first?
That's and
just,
that Slave One actually looks like Greedo's face too.
Yeah. It's incredible. It's so good.
Now, you've had action figures and Lego versions of and all yeah. sorts of collectible versions of yourself from Stranger Things, but I imagine having your own Star Wars Lego minifigure is pretty cool.
That's kind of just like the cool. Yeah, that's I've been carrying him around with me all day. I've just been like fidgeting with him because they gave me like a copy and it's awesome. And like I'm looking at like one of the sets right now and seeing Beach Luke and Jedi Vader and like just geeking out that I get to be a part of this.
Yeah. Now, I imagine you, when you recorded dialogue, you did that probably by yourself in the sound booth, right?
Yeah, I did.
Were you able to interact with Mark Hamill at all at any point?
No, I wasn't. I've met Mark once, and of course, in the context of me being the dorkiest fan in the world. I remember I distinctly had like a cool conversation starter because it was the anniversary of Batman releasing.
Okay.
And of his show releasing. Yeah. And I remember I was like, that's my in. I'll congratulate him on the anniversary of the release of his show because he gives like the most incredible performance. It's my favorite Joker. And that's saying a lot because there are brilliant Jokers and there have been, you know, like I think arguably like four or five, like the most iconic performances in superhero history.
Yeah.
But I don't think he thought it was that cool of a reference because I'm sure like 90 other dorks also said the same thing to him that day. He's the nicest guy in the world. And I remember when we went in to record this, I didn't know that they were getting any original cast members. And they were like, we might get Mark. And I was like, good luck. And they did. I remember them like, yeah, we got him. It's confirmed. And we like collectively in the room just jumped up and down, like freaking out. Like I wasn't involved in, of course, that. I was just there to record the lines. But yeah. As a, of course, a massive fan of the franchise as well as the creators of the show are, we're all so excited that he's on board for this.
Yeah, and he's having a lot of fun too because he gets to do a version of Luke that no one's ever seen before.
That's probably why he wanted to sign on, I think. Because, you know, I mean, he's been playing Luke for since 1977. I mean, they probably recorded the movie in 75 or 76. So for so long, he's been associated with this character in this world. And to just have something that's like super fresh and goofy and low stakes is probably really fun. Also, he's one of the most iconic voice actors alive today. So it like combines like his two like most like his two strengths in is his career that he's most known for in this project. And I think that's really, really fun because he's a brilliant performer outside of Star Wars.
Absolutely. Well, I was curious, what was something about voice acting compared to shooting on a set for live action that like you weren't expecting to be so challenging?
Well, I've done a lot of voice work throughout my time, especially just like post Stranger Things. It's always it's one of the easier things to be able to do while filming because right. you can schedule it for whatever day you need. You don't need to end up on set. You can film because I recorded in Atlanta when I'm filming Stranger Things. I've recorded in New York where I live. So it's really flexible. So that's kind of really refreshing when it comes to voice acting is that you kind of just get that freedom. You can show up in your sweats if you need to. But also, it's pretty daunting. Like I always like I warm up my voice the same way I would if I was singing that day because you need to kind of demonstrate your full range in the booth because that's the only thing the audience and the animators really have to go off of is how animated you can be so that they can have a better job. So you can run around the room, do jumping jacks, flail your arms all over the place, do whatever you want. You don't have to be as body conscious. You can basically do whatever you need to get that out, and that's really, really fun. And helps me feel a little bit looser in projects that are either on stage or on screen.
Okay. I wanted to note, maybe like in Star Wars, there's like this delineation between Lego Star Wars and regular Star Wars, especially since like you have this whole separate universe now.
Yeah.
there's the door still open. Do you hope that maybe you can one day be part of the live action Star Wars universe?
That's the goal. So I was like, this is my thing. I was joining. I'm like, maybe this is just my mark. I leave in the Star Wars universe. And I'm like, I'm so stoked if that's the case. But I'm also like, because it's animated, maybe I can make the jump.
There you go.
So who knows if this will help my chance or hurt my chance. I don't know. But either way, I'm just so stoked to be a part of the universe at all.
Yeah, of course. I wanted to find out, are you a Lego collector yourself?
I wouldn't say collector. I build a bunch of sets and then I don't know where to put them. And but I think, yeah, that's kind of, I'm like, I don't have space for it. But I do have storage boxes full of Lego sets that I've built over years, and not like nicely set up ones either. I'm like, I did that and played with it for a week and now it's in this box and it's going to crumble. But yeah, it's one of the more soothing things ever. Like if I get a new set, they like here over at Lego, they sent some of the new sets from the show that haven't been released yet. And I've been building them at home. And it is like a thing I do for my day. Like if it's a stress, I'm like, it's a me thing. I this is upsetting. I don't like building Legos with other people. Because it's like just for you. Like you open it up and it's a step-by-step thing and you just like lock in and then like you just admire the beautiful work you've done, even though all you've done is follow an instruction. It's like when you like it's like when you get like those like delivery cook services where you're like, I cooked today, but like everything was done for you in prep for it. Yeah. That's kind of how it feels. I'm like, I built something.
Sense of accomplishment though, especially the bigger ones.
Yeah. Especially the bigger ones, because that's more of a time commitment than anything.
Oh yeah, 100%. You talked earlier that you have different Star Wars collectibles, props, and whatnot. What is the one piece of Star Wars memorabilia that you are like the most proud to have?
I have this is cringy. I loved going on to like off-brand sites that make lightsabers that they're not allowed to call lightsabers,
yeah.
Like because they're not licensed by Star Wars, but like they like make like custom metal hilts and like stunt blades that you can like clash like crazy, and they're like way too expensive, but like I love them so much. And I have one that I designed like that I like based in my mind on like what an Old Republic lightsaber would look like when the Jedi were like no longer using their lightsabers very often, when it was more of like that ceremonial piece of like it looking like gold and regal, and it's much more of like a religious item and relic than it is of like an active weapon of battle. And yeah. I think that's what's really, really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it looks super sick too. It's like a long, like a staff hilted lightsaber too, okay. Which I think is super cool.
What color is your blade?
Blue. I always go blue.
Nice. Have you gone through the experience at Disneyland of building your own lightsaber there?
Yeah, I have. It rocks. It's so fun.
Like a religious experience.
It is. Like I'm like, oh my god, it's amazing. I don't know how they were going to do it either. And I'm like, no spoilers for people who like didn't end up getting to do it yet, who plan on doing it. But when you see like the hilt revealed like in the table, it's like the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, it's a fantastic process. I made it a lot.
It's so fun. And it's just like, a part of me wishes I was like 9 when I did it. But of course, like it wasn't there until I was like 16. So
I wanted to say one of the things I loved seeing you do was the cameo in the Please Don't Destroy movie,
which thanks. Was
absolutely hilarious. I wondered if you could talk a bit about working with those guys and how they pitched that to you.
Well, I'm a huge fan of all their work. Martin Benajohn are really, really great. And the stuff they've been doing on SNL and outside of it has been like really refreshing. And I think it's like such a cool transition into comedy now. They have like a really good grasp on what it is that's going to resonate. And I think it's a freaking fun movie. And I met them once before that. And after talking with them and mentioning how much I love their work and getting to know them a little bit, they knew the movie was coming up and they just approached and like, can you be a douche version of yourself? I was like, sign me up. That sounds great. Like, I hope it's a reach, but maybe it's not as much of a reach, but yeah, it was an absolute blast. And when they said Conan was involved, it was like no brainer. Cause it's Conan's, I think it was his feature debut where he didn't play himself. So it was his first time like taking on a role like that. And there's a scene that we shot that I didn't end up making the final cut of the movie. Cause there's so much in that film where they just riffed and riffed and had so much to play off of that they had to condense it to fit it in theaters and on streaming. But there's a whole chunk of time that I got to do just improv scene work with Conan, which was like an absolute
awesome.
Dream. Because you know he's one of the best improv actors alive today. He's an absolute icon. So to sit there and riff with him was a great learning experience, really fun, and yeah, it was a blast.
Obviously, Stranger Things is, you know, the end is in sight. But obviously you want to keep acting, you want to do things like that. Do you have your sights set on like what kind of projects you want to do following Stranger Things? Do you see yourself veering more into comedy? Do you think that maybe like a big screen musical is possible since you've done so much work on stage?
I don't know. That'd be fun. I always am so anxious about movie musicals because they're historically so hit or miss. But when they hit, they hit. And that's like what's so exciting. But also, it would be so much fun. I think right now my goal is to just kind of do things that I haven't, especially in the next coming year. That's like before the release of Five and stuff. Like there's going to be some time where they're editing. So maybe I can do some stuff that like just challenges. I want to challenge myself and kind of expand my horizons as much as I can. And I would love to step back into the theater consistently.
Yeah. Are there any filmmakers that are like on your wish list that you would like to would work with in the future?
Oh, there's a bunch. I keep getting asked this question, and I always say, like, I always get flustered. I don't know why, because I've said, like, the same. For some reason, like, this past week, I've been saying Boots Riley a bunch because I've been watching some of his work, and it's brilliant. He's one of the more innovative filmmakers doing it. Weirdly today I was talking about the same situation. I was talking about Cooper Rafe as well, because that's like a very completely different filmmaker, but like someone who's younger and has a great grasp on what it is that's going to resonate now. And because it's really hard, a lot of times filmmakers have a hard time really grasping what like the modern experience of someone in their early 20s is like. And so have somebody who's in their early 20s making movies about being in their early 20s. It's kind of like the same way that Kevin Smith was doing that when he was making his early stuff. Like, there's very few people who are able to kind of grasp that concept and do it well. So he's doing it brilliantly, I think.
Yeah, no, Shit House is fantastic.
Yeah, he's great.
I'm eager to see more from him, absolutely.
Yeah, me too.
What were some of your cinematic touchstones growing up that like have been kind of really shaped your love for movies?
Star Wars is obviously like the absolute cornerstone of what it is that got me into cinema in the first place. That's it. It helped me develop my love for being on a set and seeing what could be created from something so small, because of course it's like the most like rags to riches story of a movie in history. It's like the smallest, weirdest concept that like somebody had to take a leap of faith on, and now it's the largest franchise in the world. So like seeing that is like so inspiring, obviously. But it was so many musicals growing up is kind of why I ended up loving it. Like I remember I watched Chicago growing up a bunch, because that's like the perfect movie musical, and it's very rare for them to really nail it on the head and kind of transfer from the stage to the screen the way they did. And I think that's a perfect movie. And Pixar too was just like, it's just I was always really drawn to like visual feats of like really like things that push the boundaries. And I mean, no one did that like Pixar. So I mean, Finding Nemo, I watched maybe once a month. It's my favorite movie of all time.
Pixar is absolutely good stuff. I wanted to talk about Stranger Things a little bit too, but
Yeah, please.
you can't say anything about season five I without the Duffer
Yeah,
Duffer sending the assassin.
like they're looking, they're always watching.
But I wondered if you could talk about the evolution of Dustin and how you've see him growing over the years since the show started.
That's been, weirdly enough, one of the easier aspects of the show, I think, because I've grown right alongside with him. So anything that like I've experienced in my life or any of the ways that I change, I can kind of just let that happen with him as well, and things are going to resonate. I think, honestly, for the most part, Matt Ross seemed to know me better than I know myself. They seem to know Dustin more than I ever could. So like they're what they put on paper is. Oh, it always makes it an easy dance set to look down and be like, great, okay, cool. I have these tools and this incredible creative team assisting me and helping me grow this kid. Yeah, but especially going into this last season of seeing it all wrap up and reading it and seeing how that arc is completing itself over the course of filming, it's really satisfying. It's really cathartic. And I'm just really stoked for people to see it.
Has there ever been like any specific moment of like direction or guidance that the Duffers provided you that really helped you hone in on something like an important detail in Dustin as a character?
So weirdly enough, so much of what I think there are certain aspects of Dustin that I think are reflected off of Matt and Ross themselves, because anything they put on paper, they're always going to put a piece of themselves into, and they are quintessential perfectionists. They do not finish a take unless they get it the way they need it. And I think Dustin's kind of similar in that sense of, because he's always been a very, he's an analytical mind. He's a brilliant kid. He's a lot smarter than I am. And I think there's just a drive to be the best that he possibly can be, even to the extent of where it is self-destructive sometimes on his part. And I think like that's something that they always watch out for, and it's something that I admire so greatly about them. And I think it's what makes the show so unique. And I think it's something that makes the show better off, is their mind and the way that they go about shooting a show. Cause I've never seen a director's work the way they do. And it's very rare to work with directors who are co-directing something. So to have most of my work be in that collaborative state of like these guys who, I mean, they're twin brothers. There's always that twin thing of like, they're just like interlocked consistently. Like we could probably like do a perfect interaction of what they do when they say cut and how they interact with each other, and then go back to how they film. And I think Dustin kind of has that weird duality of like, is like a clashing of,
yeah,
of his two sides.
Well, thanks for talking to me, Gate, and I really appreciate it. Rebuilding Galaxy, a lot of fun.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, and then I just wanted to mention, because I don't think we said it at the top of the show, Lego Star Wars Rebuild the Galaxy is a 4-part series, and I think all 4 parts are on Disney Plus right now, so people can check that out there if they are so inclined. So I think that's going to do it, Brad, unless you have any final thoughts on anything or anything that you wanted to say but didn't get a chance to?
No, I think that's pretty much it.
Cool. All right. Well, you can find more about this project and some of the other Lego Star Wars stuff and plenty of classic Star Wars at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a few things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
At the UPS Store, we understand the importance of a first impression. That's why we're here to help you put your best foot forward and be unstoppable with our printing services. With high-quality paper stock options, banners, business cards, venues, and more, we make sure your small business stands out and your message reaches the masses. After all, we're the one-stop prints that pop store. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, prices, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Come into your local store today and get your print on.